to praise her in the Encyclopédie. This letter, together with several others, disappeared at the Hôtel de Luxembourg, while my papers were deposited there. The following was my reply. "Sir, I have not waited for your letter before expressing to Madame la Maréchale de Luxembourg the pain which the imprisonment of the Abbé Morellet caused me. She knows the interest which I take in the matter. She shall also know the interest that you take in it. It will be sufficient for her, in order that she herself may take an interest in it, to know that he is a person of merit. Further, although she and Monsieur le Maréchal honour me with the kindness which is the consolation of my life, and although your friend's name is, in their opinion, a recommendation in favour of the Abbé Morellet, I do not know how far they may consider it fitting, on this occasion, to make use of the influence attached to their position and the personal esteem in which they are held. I do not even feel convinced that the act of vengeance in question concerns Madame la Princesse de Robec so much as you appear to think. And even should you be correct, one must not suppose that the pleasure of avenging oneself is the exclusive property of philosophers, and that when they choose to be women, women will be philosophers. I will inform you of what Madame de Luxembourg says to me when I have shown her your letter. Meanwhile, I think that I am sufficiently well acquainted with her to be able to assure you beforehand that, even if she should have the pleasure of contributing to the release of the Abbé Morellet, she would certainly refuse to accept the tribute of gratitude which you promised to render her in the columns of the Encyclopédie, although she might feel herself honoured by it, because she does not do good for the sake of praise, but only in order to satisfy her goodness of heart. I spared no pains to arouse the zeal and compassion of Madame de Luxembourg on behalf of the poor prisoner, and I succeeded. She took a journey to Versailles on purpose to see Monsieur le Comte de Saint-Florentin, and this journey shortened her stay at Montmorency, which the Maréchal was obliged to leave at the same time, his presence being required at Rouen, whither the King was sending him as the governor of Normandy. In connection with certain proceedings in the Parliament, which it was desired to suppress. The following is the letter which Madame de Luxembourg wrote to me the second day after her departure. Packet D, number 23. Versailles, Wednesday. Monsieur de Luxembourg left yesterday at 6 o'clock in the morning. I do not yet know whether I shall join him. I am waiting to hear from him because he does not know himself how long he will be there. I have seen Monsieur de Saint-Florentin, who is most favourably disposed towards the Abbé Morellet, but he finds that there are difficulties which, however, he hopes to surmount the first time he has to see the King, which will be next week. I have also asked as a favour that he shall not be banished, which was talked of. It was intended to send him to Nancy. This, sir, is as much as I have been able to do, but I promise you that I will not leave Monsieur de Saint-Florentin alone until the matter is arranged as you desire. And now, let me tell you how sorry I was to be obliged to leave you so soon, but I flatter myself that you have no doubt of it. I love you with all my heart and shall do so as long as I live. A few days later I received the following letter from D'Alembert, which caused me real joy. Packet D, number 26. August the 1st. Thanks to your efforts, my dear philosopher, the Abbé has left the Bastille, and his imprisonment will have no further consequences. He is setting out for the country, and together with myself sends you 1,000 thanks and compliments. Vale et me amar. The Abbé also, a few days afterwards, wrote me a letter of thanks, packet D, number 29, which did not appear to me to come straight, and in which he appeared to some extent to depreciate the service which I had rendered him. And some time afterwards I found that he and D'Alembert had, in a manner I will not say supplanted, but succeeded me in Madame de Luxembourg's favour, and that I had lost in her esteem as much as they had gained. However, I am far from suspecting the Abbé Morellet of having contributed to my loss of favour. I esteem him too highly to think that. As for Monsieur D'Alembert, I say nothing about him here. I will return to him later. At the same time, I had another affair on hand, which was the occasion of the last letter I ever wrote to Voltaire, a letter which he exclaimed loudly against as an abominable insult, but which he never showed to anyone. I will here supply the omission. The Abbé Troublet, with whom I was slightly acquainted, but of whom I had seen very little, wrote to me on the 13th of June, 1760, packet D, number 11, to inform me that Monsieur Formy, his friend and correspondent, had printed in his journal my letter to Monsieur de Voltaire about the disaster at Lisbon. The Abbé Troublet wanted to know how this publication had been rendered possible, and with his Jesuitical slyness asked me my opinion of the reprinting of the letter, without wanting to tell me his own. As I thoroughly detest cunning persons of this sort, I thanked him, as he deserved, but somewhat stiffly. He noticed this, but nevertheless it did not prevent him from trying to get over me in one or two more letters, until he had found out everything he wanted to know. I well understood, whatever Troublet might say, that Formy had not found the letter printed, and that it had been printed by him for the first time. I knew that he was an unblushing pilferer, who, without ceremony, earned an income from the works of others, although he had not yet ventured upon the astounding impudence of removing the author's name from a book already published, putting his own to it, and selling it for his own profit. In this fashion he afterwards appropriated Emile. But how had this manuscript come into his hands? That was the question. It was not a difficult one to answer, but I was simple enough to be puzzled by it. Although Voltaire was honoured beyond all measure in this letter, he would have had reason to complain, in spite of his uncivil behaviour, if I had had it printed without his consent, and I accordingly decided to write to him on the matter. Here is the second letter, to which he made no reply, and at which, in order to give freer vent to his brutality, he pretended to be irritated even to madness. Montmorency, June the 7th, 1760. Sir, I never thought to find myself writing to you again, but having learned that the letter which I wrote to you in 1756 has been printed at Berlin, I feel it my duty to give you an account of my conduct in regard to it, and I will fulfil this duty in all truthfulness and sincerity. This letter, having been really addressed to yourself, was never meant to be printed. I communicated its contents, conditionally, to three persons to whom the rights of friendship did not permit me to refuse anything of the kind, and whom these same rights of friendship still less permitted to abuse their trust by violating their promise. These three persons are Madame de Chenonceau, Madame Dupin's stepdaughter, Madame la Comtesse d'Udetot, and a German named Grimm. Madame de Chenonceau was anxious for the letter to be printed, and asked my consent. I told her that it depended upon you. Your consent was asked, you refused it, and nothing more was said about the matter. Nevertheless, Monsieur l'Abbé Troublet, with whom I have no sort of connection, has just written, with a most friendly mark of attention, to inform me that he has received the sheets of a journal belonging to Monsieur Formy, in which he has read this identical letter, accompanied by a note, in which the editor, under date of the 23rd of October 1759, says that he found it some weeks ago in the Berlin booksellers' shops, and that, since it is one of those pamphlets which soon disappear beyond hope of return, he thought it his duty to allot it a place in his journal. This, sir, is all that I know about the matter. It is quite certain that hitherto this letter has never even been heard of in Paris. It is quite certain that the copy, whether in manuscript or print, which has fallen into Monsieur Formy's hands, can only have come to him either through you, which is not likely, or through one of the three persons whom I have just mentioned. Lastly, it is quite certain that the two ladies are incapable of such a breach of confidence. From my retreat I cannot gain any further information about the matter. You have correspondents, by whose assistance it would be easy for you, if it were worth the trouble, to trace it back to its source, and learn the truth about the facts. In the same letter, Monsieur l'Abbé Troublet informs me that he is keeping back the number of the journal, and will not lend it without my consent, which I certainly will never give. But this copy may not be the only one in Paris. My wish is that the letter may not be printed there, and I will do my best to prevent it. But in case I am unable to succeed, and being informed in time, may be able to secure the prior right, then I will not hesitate to have it printed myself. This appears to me to be only fair and natural. As for your reply to the same letter, it has not been communicated to anyone, and you may feel assured that it will never be printed without your consent. That is to say, during his lifetime and mine, and surely the most scrupulous behaviour, especially in dealing with a man who tramples it ruthlessly underfoot, cannot require more. Which I shall never be so indiscreet as to ask for I know well that what one man writes to another is not meant for the public. But if you like to write an answer for publication addressed to me, I promise you that I will faithfully add it to my letter, without a single word of reply on my part. I do not love you, sir. You have done me injuries, which I could not but feel most deeply. Me, your disciple and most enthusiastic admirer. You have ruined Geneva in return for the shelter you have found there. You have alienated my fellow citizens from me, in return for the eulogies which I have lavished upon you in their midst. It is you who have made life in my native country unendurable for me. It is you who will cause me to die in a foreign land, deprived of all the consolations of a dying man, and to be thrown into a gutter as the last token of respect, while you will be followed to the grave with all the honours that a man can expect. In fact, I hate you, since you have so willed it, but I hate you as a man who is more worthy loving you, if you had so chosen. Of all the sentiments towards you, with which my heart was filled, the only one that survives is the admiration which one cannot refuse to your splendid genius, and admiration for your writings. If I can honour nothing but your talents, the fault is not mine. I shall never fail in the respect that is due to them, or in the behaviour which such respect demands. Farewell, sir. It will be observed that although this letter has been written nearly 7 years, I have neither mentioned it nor shown it to a living soul. This has also been the case with the two letters which Monsieur Hume forced me to write to him last summer, until he made the noise about them, which everybody knows of. The evil that I have to say about my enemies, I say to them privately. As for the good, when there is any, I say it openly and with a good heart. In the midst of all these petty literary squabbles, which only confirm me more and more in my resolution, I was the recipient of the greatest honour which the profession of letters has ever conferred upon me, and of which I felt most proud. Monsieur le Prince de Conti condescended to visit me twice, once at the little chateau and once at Mont-Louis. On both occasions, he selected the time when Madame de Luxembourg was not at Montmorency, in order to make it clearer that he only came to see me. I have never had any doubt that I owed his kindness originally to Madame de Luxembourg and Madame de Boufflay, but neither have I any doubt that I owe the kindness with which he has never ceased to honour me since then to his own feelings and myself. Notice the persistency of this blind and stupid confidence in the midst of all the ill treatment, which ought to have disabused me of it. It never disappeared until after my return to Paris in 1770. As my apartment at Mont-Louis was very small, and the situation of the turret was delightful, I took the prince there, and he, to crown his favours, desired that I would have the honour of playing a game of chess with him. I knew that he could beat the Chevalier de Lorenzi, who was a much better player than myself. However, in spite of the signs and grimaces of the Chevalier and those who were present, which I pretended not to see, I won the two games which we played. When they were finished, I said to him in a respectful but serious tone, "My lord, I have too much respect for your most serene highness not to beat you always at chess." This great prince, so witty and learned, who deserved to be spared from flattery, felt, at least I think so, that I was the only person present who treated him as a man, and I have every reason to believe that he felt really grateful to me for it. Even if he had been displeased, I could not reproach myself with wishing to deceive him in anything, and I certainly have not to reproach myself with having ill-requited his goodness in my heart, although I certainly sometimes requited it with a bad grace, whereas he himself displayed infinite delicacy in the manner in which he showed it. A few days afterwards, he sent me a hamper of game, which I accepted in a proper manner. Some time after that, he sent me a second hamper, accompanied by a note from one of his officers of the hunt, written by his instructions, informing me that the contents had been shot by His Highness himself, I accepted it, but I wrote to Madame de Boufflers that I would accept no more. This letter was generally blamed, and deservedly, to refuse presents of game from a prince of the blood, who, besides, displays such delicacy in sending them, shows rather the boorishness of an ill-bred person who forgets himself than the delicate feeling of a proud man who desires to preserve his independence. I have never read over this letter without blushing for it, or without reproaching myself for having written it. However, I have not undertaken to write my confessions in order to be silent upon my follies, and the present instance disgusts me with myself too much for me to allow myself to conceal it. If I did not commit the additional folly of becoming his rival, I very nearly did so, for at the time Madame de Boufflers was still his mistress, and I knew nothing about it. She came to see me pretty often with the Chevalier de Lorenzi. She was handsome and still young. She affected the old Roman spirit, while I was always romantic. This was a sufficient similarity. I was nearly caught. I believe she saw it. The Chevalier saw it also, at least he spoke to me about it, and in a manner not calculated to discourage me. But this time I was prudent, and it was time to be so, at 50 years of age, full of the good advice which I had just given to the greybeards in my letter to D'Alembert. I was ashamed to profit so little by it myself. Besides, after learning what I did not know before, I must have lost my head entirely if I had dared to carry my rivalry so high. Lastly, being perhaps not yet thoroughly cured of my passion for Madame Doudeto, I felt that nothing could henceforth take her place in my heart, and I bade adieu to love for the remainder of my life. At the moment of writing these lines, a young woman who had her designs upon me has just made dangerous advances to me, and that with very significant glances. But if she had pretended to forget my 50 years, I have remembered them. After having extricated myself from this snare, I have no longer any fear of falling, and I feel that I can answer for myself for the rest of my days. Madame de Boufflers had observed the emotion which her presence caused me, and could also see that I had triumphed over it. I am neither foolish nor vain enough to believe that, at my age, I can have inspired her with any fancy for me. But from certain expressions which she made use of to Thérèse, I believe that I aroused a certain feeling of curiosity in her mind. If this is the case, and if she has not forgiven me for not having satisfied this curiosity, it must be admitted that I was born to be the victim of my weaknesses, since victorious love was so fatal to me, and vanquished love even more fatal still. Here ends the collection of letters which has served me as a guide in these two books. Henceforth I can only follow in the footsteps of my recollections, which, however, in reference to this cruel period of my life, are so vivid and have left so strong an impression upon me that, lost in the vast ocean of my misfortunes, I am unable to forget the details of my first shipwreck, although its results only afford me confused recollections. Accordingly, in the following book I can still proceed with tolerable certainty. If I go further, I shall have to grope in the dark. Book 11, 1761. Although Julie, which had been in the press for a long time, was not yet published at the end of 1760, it was beginning to make a great stir. Madame de Luxembourg had spoken of it at court, Madame Doudeto in Paris. The latter had even obtained permission from me for Saint Lambert to have it read in manuscript to the King of Poland, who was delighted with it. Duclos, to whom I'd also had it read, had spoken of it to the Academy. All Paris was impatient to see this romance. The booksellers' shops in the Rue Saint-Jacques and the Palais Royal were besieged by persons making inquiries about it. At last it appeared, and its success, contrary to what is usually the case, corresponded to the eagerness with which it had been expected. Madame la Dauphine, who was one of the first who read it, spoke of it to Monsieur de Luxembourg as a delightful work. Opinions were divided amongst men of letters, but amongst the general public the verdict was unanimous. The ladies especially became infatuated with the book and the author, to such an extent that there were few, even amongst the highest circles, whose conquest I could not have made if I had been so disposed. I possess proofs of this, which I do not wish to commit to writing, but which, without any need of putting them to the test, confirm my opinion. It is singular that this work has met with greater success in France than in the rest of Europe, although the French, both men and women, are not very well treated in it. Quite contrary to my expectation, it was least successful in Switzerland, most successful in Paris. Do, then, friendship, love, and virtue prevail more in Paris than elsewhere? Most certainly no. But there still prevails there that exquisite feeling, by which the heart is transported, when these qualities are portrayed, and which makes us cherish in others the pure, tender, and virtuous feelings which we ourselves no longer possess. The corruption of manners is at the present day everywhere the same. Virtue and morality no longer exist in Europe. But if there be a place where affection for them still exists, it is in Paris that we must look for it. Amidst so many prejudices and factitious passions, one must know how to analyze properly the human heart, in order to disentangle the true feelings of nature. A delicacy of tact is necessary, which can only be acquired by intercourse with the great world, in order to feel, if I may so venture to say, the delicacies of heart of which this work is full. I unhesitatingly place the fourth part of it by the side of the Princesse de Clèves, and I assert that if these two works had been read only in the provinces, their true value would never have been recognized. It is, therefore, not surprising that the book met with the greatest success at court. It abounds in piquant but veiled allusions, which were bound to please because those at court are more practiced in seeing through them. However, a further distinction must here be made. The reading of such works is certainly not suited to those witty people, whose cunning and finesse is only of avail to see through what is bad, and who see nothing at all where there is only good to be seen. If, for instance, Julie had been published in a certain country which I have in mind, I am sure no one would have read it to the end, and that it would have died at its birth. I have collected most of the letters which were written to me on the subject of this work in a packet which is in the hands of Madame de Nadaillac. If this collection ever sees the light, it will disclose several curious things, amongst others a diversity of opinion, which shows what it is to have anything to do with the public. The feature which has been least observed, and which will always make it a work unique of its kind, is the simplicity of the subject, and the sustained interest which, confined to three persons, is kept up through six volumes, without the aid of incidents, romantic adventures, or improprieties of any kind, either in the characters or in their actions. Diderot has paid great compliments to Richardson upon the enormous variety of his situations, and the number of characters introduced by him. Richardson certainly has the merit of having given them all distinctive characteristics, but in regard to their number he has the fault common to most insipid writers of romance, who make up for the barrenness of their ideas by the aid of characters and incidents. It is easy to excite interest by incessantly presenting unheard-of incidents and new faces, who pass like the figures in a magic lantern. But it is far more difficult to sustain this interest continually by means of the same objects, without the aid of wonderful adventures. And if, other things being equal, the simplicity of the subject adds to the beauty of the work, the romances of Richardson, though superior in so many other things, cannot, in this respect, be compared to mine. However, it is dead. I know it, and I know the reason. But it will come to life again. My only fear was that, owing to its extreme simplicity, the development of the story might prove wearisome, and that I had not been able to keep up a sufficiently lively interest to the end. I was reassured by an incident which, of itself alone, flattered me more than all the compliments which this work has procured me. It appeared at the beginning of the carnival. A book hawker took it to Madame la Princesse de Talmont. It was not she, but another lady, whose name I do not know, but I have been assured of the fact. One day, when there was a ball at the opera. After supper, she dressed herself to go, and while waiting, began to read the new romance. At midnight, she ordered her horses to be put in, and went on reading. She was informed that her carriage was waiting. She made no reply. Her servants, seeing that she'd forgotten herself, went to tell her that it was 2 o'clock. "There is no hurry yet," she answered, and still went on reading. Some time afterwards, her watch having stopped, she rang the bell to know what time it was. When she heard that it was 4 o'clock, she said, "Then it is too late to go to the ball. Take out the horses." Undressed herself and spent the rest of the night in reading. Since hearing of this incident, I've always wanted to see Madame de Talmont, not only to learn from her own lips if it is strictly true, but also because I've never thought it possible that anyone could feel so lively an interest in Julie without possessing the sixth sense, that moral sense, with which so few hearts are endowed, and without which it is impossible for anyone to understand my own. What made the women so favourably disposed towards me was their conviction that I'd written my own history, and that I myself was the hero of this romance. This belief was so firmly established that Madame de Polignac wrote to Madame de Verdelin, begging her to persuade me to let her see the portrait of Julie. Everyone was convinced that it was impossible to express sentiments so vividly without having felt them, or to describe the transports of love so glowingly, unless they came straight from the heart. In this they were right. It is quite true that I wrote this romance in a state of most feverish ecstasy, but they were wrong in thinking that it had needed real objects to produce this condition. They were far from understanding to what an extent I am capable of being inflamed by beings of the imagination. Had it not been for a few reminiscences of my youth and Madame Dudetot, the love which I felt and described would have had only the nymphs of the air for its object. I did not desire either to confirm or refute an error which was to my advantage. It may be seen in the preface, in the form of a dialogue, which I had printed separately, how I left the public in suspense on that point. Rigid moralists may say that I ought to have declared the truth without reserve. For my own part, I do not see what obligation there was for me to do so, and I think that I should have shown far more stupidity than frankness in making such a declaration, when there was no necessity for it. Nearly about the same time appeared the Paix Perpetuelle, the manuscript of which I had given up in the preceding year to a certain Monsieur de Bastide, editor of a journal called Le Monde, into which, whether I liked it or not, he would have been glad to cram all my manuscripts. He was acquainted with Monsieur Duclos, and came in his name to try and induce me to help him to fill his journal. He had heard Julie spoken of, and wanted me to let it appear in it, as well as Émile. He would also have liked to have the Contrat Social, if he had had any suspicion of its existence. At length, wearied by his importunities, I decided to let him have my extracts from the Paix Perpetuelle for 12 louis. The agreement was that it should be printed in his journal. But as soon as he became the owner of the manuscript, he thought fit to have it printed by itself, after certain passages had been cut out, in accordance with the requirements of the censorship. What would have been the result, if I had added my own criticisms of the work, which fortunately I did not mention to Monsieur de Bastide, and which were not included in our agreement? These criticisms are still unprinted, and I have them amongst my papers. If they ever appear, it will be seen how Voltaire's witticisms and self-complacency on this subject must have made me laugh, me who understood so well the extent of this poor man's intelligence in regard to the political matters in which he ventured to interfere. In the midst of the successful reception of my work by the public, and the favour of the ladies, I felt that I was losing ground at the Hôtel de Luxembourg, not with Monsieur de Luxembourg, whose kindness and friendship seemed to increase daily, but with Madame de Luxembourg. Since I had found nothing more to read to her, her room had not been so freely opened to me, and during her visits to Montmorency, although I presented myself with great regularity, I hardly ever saw her except at table. My place at her side, even, was no longer reserved for me as before. As she no longer offered it to me, spoke to me but little, and I had not much to say to her either, I was glad to find another place where I was more at my ease, especially in the evening, for I unconsciously made a practice of sitting closer to Monsieur le Maréchal. In regard to the evening, I remember that I have said that I did not sup at the chateau, and this was true at the commencement of our acquaintance. But as Monsieur de Luxembourg did not dine at all, and did not even appear at table, the result was that, at the end of several months, although I was on a very familiar footing in the house, I had never been at a meal with him. He was kind enough to make a remark to that effect. This decided me to go to supper there sometimes, when there were not many guests. And I greatly enjoyed myself, seeing that we took our dinner almost in the open, and, as is said, sur le bout du banc, without ceremony. Whereas supper was a very lengthy meal, because the guests made themselves comfortable in order to rest themselves after a long walk. It was a very good meal, because Monsieur de Luxembourg was somewhat of a gourmand, and a very agreeable one, because Madame de Luxembourg did the honours with charming grace. Without this explanation, it would be difficult to understand the concluding portion of one of Monsieur de Luxembourg's letters, packet C, number 36, in which he tells me that he recalls our walks with great pleasure, especially, he adds, when on our return to the courtyard in the evening, we found no marks of carriage wheels. For, as the ruts in the sand were raked over every morning, I guessed, from the number of wheel tracks, how many guests had arrived during the afternoon. This year, 1761, filled to the brim the cup of the afflictions which this worthy gentleman had suffered, since I had had the honour of knowing him, as if the evils which destiny was preparing for myself were fated to commence with the man to whom I felt the most sincere attachment, and who was most worthy of it. In the first year he lost his sister, Madame la Duchesse de Villeroy. In the second, his daughter, Madame la Princesse de Robec. In the third, his only son, the Duc de Montmorency, and his grandson, the Comte de Luxembourg, the last and only inheritors of his name and family. Outwardly he endured all these losses with apparent courage, but his heart did not cease to bleed inwardly for the rest of his life, and his health gradually declined. He must have felt the unexpected and tragic end of his son the more keenly, as it happened at the very moment when the king had just granted him for his son, and promised him for his grandson, the reversion of his commission as captain of the Garde du Corps. He had the sorrow of seeing, before his own eyes, the life of this child in whom such hopes were centred, gradually wasting away, in consequence of the mother's blind confidence in the physician who caused the poor child's death from sheer want of nourishment, owing to his being fed upon nothing but drugs. Alas, if they had only trusted in me, the grandfather and the grandson would both be still alive. I said everything I could. I wrote to Monsieur le Maréchal. I remonstrated with Madame de Montmorency upon the more than strict diet which, in her faith in her physician, she prescribed for her son. Madame de Luxembourg, whose opinions coincided with my own, did not wish to usurp the mother's authority. Monsieur de Luxembourg, who was weak and gentle, never cared to oppose anyone. Madame de Montmorency felt a confidence in Bourdieu, of which her son finally became the victim. How delighted the poor child was when he was able to get permission to come to Mont-Louis with Madame de Boufflers to ask Thérèse for something to eat, and to put a little nourishment into his famished stomach. How I deplored in my own heart the miseries of greatness, when I saw the only heir of so large an estate, of so great a name, of so many titles and dignities, devour with the greediness of a beggar a sorry morsel of bread. But it was no use for me to say or do anything. The physician triumphed, and the child starved. The same confidence in quacks, which caused the death of the grandson, dug the grave of the grandfather, and in addition to this he was weak-minded enough to attempt to conceal from himself the infirmities of old age. Monsieur de Luxembourg suffered at times from pains in his great toe. He had an attack while at Montmorency, which prevented him from sleeping, and made him somewhat feverish. I ventured to pronounce the word gout. Madame de Luxembourg scolded me. The maréchal's valet de chambre and surgeon declared that it was not the gout and proceeded to dress the part afflicted with some healing ointment. Unfortunately, the pain abated, and when it returned, recourse was invariably had to the same remedy which had previously given relief. His constitution broke up, his sufferings increased, and the remedies in proportion. Madame de Luxembourg, who at last saw that it was the gout, opposed this senseless treatment. They afterwards concealed his condition from her, and he died at the end of a few years, through his own fault and his persistent efforts to cure himself. But let me not so far anticipate misfortunes. How many others have I to relate before I come to that? It is strange by what fatality all that I could say or do seemed doomed to displease Madame de Luxembourg, even when I was exceedingly anxious to preserve her goodwill. The blows which Monsieur de Luxembourg sustained, one after another, only made me more attached to him, and consequently to Madame de Luxembourg, for they always seemed to me so sincerely united that the feelings which I entertained for the one naturally extended to the other. Monsieur le Maréchal was getting old. His constant attendance at court, the duties entailed by it, the continual hunting expeditions, above all the fatigues of his office during the 3 months he was on duty, would have required the vigour of a young man, and I no longer saw anything which could keep up his strength in the position which he occupied. Since his dignities would be distributed amongst others, and his name would become extinct after his death, there was little need for him to continue a laborious life, the chief object of which had been to secure the prince's favour for his children. One day, when we three were alone, and he was complaining of the fatigue of his court duties, like a man disheartened by his losses, I ventured to speak to him of retiring, and to give him the advice which Cineas gave to Pyrrhus. He sighed, but made no decided answer. But the very first time she saw me alone, Madame de Luxembourg scolded me severely for this advice, which seemed to me to have alarmed her. She added a remark, the justice of which I felt, and which made me abandon the idea of ever referring to the same topic again, that the habit of living so long at the court had become a real necessity, that even at that moment it was a diversion for Monsieur de Luxembourg, and that the retirement which I recommended to him would not be so much a rest for him as an exile, in which idleness, weariness, and grief would soon put an end to his life. Although she must have seen that she had convinced me, although she could depend upon the promise which I made and kept, she never seemed to me quite easy in regard to the matter. And I remember that, since that time, my tête-à-têtes with Monsieur le Maréchal were less frequent, and were nearly always interrupted. While my awkwardness and ill luck thus united to injure me in her opinion, the people of whom she saw most, and for whom she entertained the greatest affection, did not promote my interest in that quarter, the Abbé de Boufflers especially, who was as brilliant as a young man could possibly be, never seemed particularly well disposed towards me. Not only is he the only person in Madame la Maréchale's circle who has never shown me the slightest marks of attention, but I fancied that I observed that, after each of his visits to Montmorency, I lost ground with her. Certainly, however, it is true that, without any attention on his part, the mere fact of his presence was sufficient to account for it. So dull and heavy did my clumsy spropositi appear by the side of his graceful and refined wit. That is to say, my absurdities, my blunders. During the first 2 years, his visits to Montmorency had been very rare, and thanks to the indulgence of Madame la Marquise, I had held my ground tolerably well. But as soon as he made his appearance with tolerable regularity, I was crushed beyond hope of recovery. I should have liked to take refuge under his wing, and to make him my friend, but the same awkwardness which made his favour a necessity to me prevented me from gaining it, and my maladroit efforts in that direction ended by completely ruining me with Madame la Maréchale, without being of any service to me in regard to him. With his intellect, he might have succeeded in everything, but his total incapacity for steady application and his taste for amusement only permitted him to acquire imperfect accomplishments of every description. By way of compensation, these attainments were extensive, and that is all that is necessary in the great world in which he is anxious to shine. He can compose pretty little poems, write pretty little notes, can play a little on the cither, and daub a little in pastel. He undertook to paint Madame de Luxembourg's portrait. The result was horrible. She declared that it was not in the least like her, which was quite true. The traitorous abbé consulted me, and I, like a fool and a liar, said that it was like her. I wanted to flatter the abbé, but I did not flatter Madame la Maréchale, who scored it down against me. And the abbé, after his trick had succeeded, laughed at me. I learned, through the result of my tardy first attempt, never again to attempt to play the sycophant and flatterer. Invita Minerva. That is written malgré Minerve, specially applied to a poet who persists in writing verses in spite of his having no talent for it. My ability lay in telling useful but hard truths to mankind with a certain amount of energy and courage, and I ought to have stopped at that. I was not born, I will not say to flatter, but to praise. The awkwardness of the praises which I attempted to bestow has done me more harm than all the severity of my reproaches. I will here quote a terrible example of this, the consequences of which have not only decided my destiny for the rest of my life, but will perhaps decide my reputation among posterity. When the family stayed at Montmorency, Monsieur de Choiseul sometimes came to supper at the chateau. He came one day as I was leaving it. They spoke about me. Monsieur de Luxembourg told him the history of my relations with Monsieur de Montaigu at Venice. Monsieur de Choiseul said that it was a pity that I'd abandoned the diplomatic career, and that, if I was inclined to enter it again, it would give him great pleasure to find me employment. Monsieur de Luxembourg repeated this to me, as I was not accustomed to be spoiled by ministers. I felt it all the more. And I am not at all sure that, if my health had permitted me to entertain the idea, I should not have made a fool of myself again, in spite of my resolutions. Ambition only took possession of me during the brief intervals when all other passions left me alone. But one of these intervals would have been sufficient to enlist my sympathies again. This kindly intention on Monsieur de Choiseul's part gained my affection and strengthened the esteem which some of the proceedings of his ministry had caused me to entertain for his talents. The Pacte de Famille, in particular, appeared to me to indicate a statesman of the first rank. This was a treaty of defensive alliance concluded in 1761 between the two branches of the House of Bourbon in France and Spain. He gained my esteem still more from the poor opinion I had of his predecessors, not even excepting Madame de Pompadour, whom I looked upon as a sort of prime minister. And when it was currently reported that one of those two would drive out the other, I believed that I was offering prayers for the glory of France, when I prayed for the triumph of Monsieur de Choiseul. I'd always had a feeling of antipathy against Madame de Pompadour, even when I saw her, before she had risen to power, at Madame de Popinière's, while she was still Madame d'Etieux. Since then I had been annoyed by her silence in the matter of Diderot, and the manner in which she had behaved towards me, both in regard to the Fête de Ramire, the Muse Galante, and the Divin du Village, which had by no means brought me advantages proportionate to its success. In all these cases I had found very little inclination on her part to oblige me. This, however, did not prevent the Chevalier de Lorenzi from proposing to me to write something in praise of this lady, at the same time giving me to understand that it might be useful to me. This proposal made me the more indignant, as I saw clearly that it did not come from him. I knew well that this man, who was totally insignificant in himself, never thought or acted except as he was prompted by others. I am not sufficiently capable of putting restraint upon myself to have been able to conceal from him my contempt for his proposition, or, from anyone else, my dislike for the favourite, which I am convinced she knew. All these considerations united my self-interest to my natural inclination in the prayers which I offered for the success of Monsieur de Choiseul. Already prepossessed in favour of his abilities, which was the extent of my acquaintance with him, full of gratitude for his good intentions. In addition, totally ignorant, in my retirement, of his tastes and manner of life, I regarded him by anticipation as the avenger of the public and myself. And as I was at the time engaged in putting the finishing touches to the Contrat Social, I set down, in a single passage, my opinion of preceding ministries, and of that which was beginning to eclipse them all. On this occasion I offended against my most firmly established principle, and further, I did not reflect that, when one desires to praise or blame strongly in the same article, without mentioning names, it is necessary to apportion the praise to those for whom it is intended, in such a manner that the most sensitive amour propre cannot possibly misunderstand it. In regard to this, I felt so foolishly secure that it never even occurred that it could be possible for anyone to be mistaken. It will soon be seen whether I was right. It had been one of my misfortunes to be always connected with authoresses. I thought that amongst the great I should at least be free from this. Not at all. My misfortune still pursued me. As far as I know, Madame de Luxembourg was never attacked by this complaint. But Madame de Boufflers was. She wrote a tragedy in prose, which was at first read, sent round, and praised up in Monsieur le Prince de Conti's circle. And not satisfied with all these eulogies, she wanted to ask my opinion also, in order to secure my approbation. I gave it, and praised the work in the moderate terms which it deserved. I also informed her, as I thought was only right, that her piece, entitled L'Esclave Généreux, had a great resemblance to a little-known English play, which, however, had been translated into French, called Orunoco. This was by T. Southern, 1696, founded upon a novel by Mrs. Aphra Behn. Madame de Boufflers thanked me for my opinion, but assured me that her piece had not the least resemblance to the English. I have never mentioned this plagiarism to a single person except herself, and then only to fulfil a duty which she herself had imposed upon me. But this has not prevented me from often thinking since then of the manner in which Gilles Blas fulfilled his duty to the preaching archbishop, and its results. Without mentioning the Abbé de Boufflers, who was not fond of me, and Madame de Boufflers, whom I had offended in a manner which women and authors never forgive, none of Madame la Maréchale's other friends seemed particularly inclined to become mine. I may mention Monsieur le Président Hainaut, who, as a member of the Society of Authors, was not free from their faults. Madame du Deffand and Mademoiselle de l'Espinasse, both of them on intimate terms with Voltaire and D'Alembert, with the latter of whom Mademoiselle de l'Espinasse finally lived, of course in a most respectable manner. Let no one imagine that I mean anything else. I had begun by feeling a lively interest in Madame du Deffand, whom I pitied on account of the loss of her eyesight. But her manner of living, so entirely contrary to mine, that she got up about the time that I went to bed, her extravagant passion for trifling displays of wit, the importance which she attached to the most contemptible rags which appeared, whether complimentary or abusive, the despotic violence of her oracular utterances, her exaggerated prepossessions in favour of or against everything which prevented her from speaking of any subject except hysterically, her incredible prejudices, her unconquerable obstinacy, her unreasoning enthusiasm to which she was carried away by the stubbornness of her impassioned judgments, all this soon discouraged me from the attentions which I was ready to pay her. I neglected her. She noticed it. This was sufficient to put her in a rage, and although I felt how greatly a woman of this character was to be feared, I preferred to expose myself to the scourge of her hatred than to that of her friendship. As if it was not enough for me to have so few friends in Madame de Luxembourg's circle, I had enemies in her family. Only one, certainly, but one who, in the situation in which I now found myself, is equal to 100. It was certainly not her brother, Monsieur le Duc de Villeroy, who not only came to see me, but invited me several times to Villeroy. And as I had answered this invitation with all possible politeness and respect, he had taken this vague answer as an acceptance, and arranged that Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg should pay him a fortnight's visit, on which it was proposed that I should accompany them. As the care of which my health required rendered it dangerous for me at that time to change my quarters, I begged Monsieur de Luxembourg to be good enough to make my excuses. It may be seen from his answer, packet D, number 3, that he did so with the best grace in the world, and Monsieur le Duc de Villeroy's kindness towards me showed no alteration. His nephew and heir, the young Marquis de Villeroy, did not share the kindly feelings with which his uncle honoured me, nor, I must confess, did I entertain the same respect for him. His frivolous behaviour made him unendurable to me, and my coldness brought upon me his dislike. One evening at table he wantonly insulted me. I came out very badly, because I'm a fool and utterly without presence of mind, and anger, instead of sharpening the little ready wit I may possess, entirely deprives me of it. I had a dog which had been given to me when it was quite a puppy, almost immediately after my arrival at the Hermitage, and which I had named Duke. This dog, which, although no beauty, was of an uncommon breed, I had made my friend and companion, and it certainly deserved the name better than the majority of those who had assumed it. It had become a favourite at the Chateau of Montmorency, owing to its sensible and affectionate disposition, and the attachment which we felt for each other. But in a moment of foolish weakness I had changed its name to Turk, as if there had not been hundreds of dogs called Marquis, without any Marquis being offended at it. The Marquis de Villeroy, who knew of this change of name, pressed me so hard upon the point that I was obliged to relate, in the presence of the company, what I'd done. What gave offence in the story was not so much that I'd given the dog the name of Duke, as that I'd afterwards altered it. The worst thing was that there were several dukes present, amongst others Monsieur de Luxembourg and his son. The Marquis de Villeroy, who was a duke presumptive and bears that title at the present day, cruelly enjoyed the embarrassing position in which he had placed me, and the effect produced by it. I was assured the next day that his aunt had severely scolded him, and it may be imagined how far this reprimand, if he really received it, must have improved my relations with him. My only protector against all these enemies, both at the Hôtel de Luxembourg and at the Temple, was the Chevalier de Lorenzi, who professed to be my friend. But he was still more the friend of D'Alembert, under whose wings he passed amongst the ladies for a great geometrician. He was, besides the gallant, or rather the tame, cat of Madame la Comtesse de Boufflers, who was herself a great friend of D'Alembert. The Chevalier de Lorenzi's very existence and thoughts depended upon her. Thus, far from my possessing any outside counterpoise to my folly which could keep me in Madame de Luxembourg's good graces, all who approached her seemed to work together to injure me in her esteem. However, besides her kindness in undertaking to see after Emile, she showed me an additional mark of favour and sympathy, which caused me to believe that even if she was getting tired of me, she still preserved, and would always preserve, the friendship which she had so often promised to entertain for me to the end of my life. As soon as I thought that I could reckon upon this feeling on her part, I began to relieve my heart by making a confession of all my faults to her, since it is an inviolable principle with me to show myself to my friends exactly as I am, neither better nor worse. I informed her of my relations with Thérèse and all their consequences, not omitting the manner in which I disposed of my children. She received my confessions kindly, even too kindly, and spared me the censure which I deserved. And what especially touched me was the kindness which she lavished upon Thérèse. She gave her little presents, sent for her, encouraged her to go and see her, received her most tenderly, and frequently kissed her before everybody. The poor girl was transported with joy and gratitude, which I certainly shared. The kindness with which Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg overwhelmed me through her touched me more than that which they showed to me directly. For a considerable time matters remained on this footing, but at last Madame la Maréchale pushed her kindness so far as to express a wish to remove and adopt one of my children. She knew that I'd put a monogram upon the eldest one's linen. She asked me for the duplicate of it, and I gave it to her. In the search she employed La Roche, her valet de chambre, and confidential servant, whose inquiries proved useless. He found out nothing, although only 12 or 14 years had elapsed. If the registers of the foundling hospital had been regularly kept, or if the inquiry had been properly conducted, the mark ought not to have been so difficult to discover. However that may be, I was less annoyed at his failure than I should have been if I had followed the child's career from its birth. If, with the assistance of the information afforded, any child had been presented to me as mine, the doubt, whether it really was so, or whether another had been substituted for it, would have tormented my heart with uncertainty, and I should not have enjoyed in all its charm the true feeling of nature, which, in order to be kept alive, must be kept up by constant familiarity, at least during infancy. The continued absence of a child whom one does not yet know weakens and at last utterly destroys the feelings of a parent. It is impossible to love a child which has been put out to nurse as much as one which is brought up at home. This reflection may extenuate the effects of my faults, but only aggravates their origin. It may be useful to observe that, through the medium of Thérèse, this same La Roche made the acquaintance of Madame Levasseur, whom Grimm still kept at Deuilly, close to La Chevrette, and only a little distance from Montmorency. After I left, it was through Monsieur La Roche that I continued to send this woman the money which I never ceased to supply her with, and I believe that he very often took presents to her from Madame la Maréchale. Thus, although she was always complaining, she was certainly not to be pitied. In regard to Grimm, as I am not fond of speaking of people whom I feel bound to hate, I never mentioned him to Madame de Luxembourg unless I was obliged to. But she several times introduced his name without telling me what she thought of him, and without ever letting me discover whether she was acquainted with the man or not. As reserved with those whom I love, and who are perfectly frank with me, is by no means to my taste, especially in what concerns them. I have sometimes reflected since then upon the reserve which she showed towards me, but only when such reflection has been rendered natural by other events. After having waited a considerable time since I had handed Emile to Madame de Luxembourg, without hearing anything about it, I at length was informed that an arrangement had been made at Paris with the bookseller Duchesne, and by him with Naomi of Amsterdam. Madame de Luxembourg sent me the two copies of the agreement with Duchesne to sign. I recognized the writing as that of Monsieur de Malesherbes' letters, which he did not write himself. The certainty that my agreement had been concluded with the consent and under the eyes of the magistrate made me sign it with confidence. Duchesne gave me 6,000 francs for the manuscript, half down, and I think 100 to 200 copies. Having signed the two documents, I sent them both to Madame de Luxembourg, in accordance with her desire. She gave one to Duchesne, and kept the other herself, instead of sending it back to me. And I have never seen it again. Although my acquaintance with Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg had interrupted my plans of retirement, they had not caused me to renounce them altogether. Even at the time when I was most in favour with Madame la Maréchale, I always felt that nothing but my sincere attachment to her and her husband could render their surroundings endurable. My whole difficulty was to unite this attachment with a manner of life more agreeable to my taste and less injurious to my health, which the perpetual restraint and the late suppers continually undermined, in spite of all the care which they took to avoid exposing me to any risk. For in this respect, as in everything else, they showed the greatest possible attention. For instance, every evening after supper, Monsieur le Maréchal, who went to bed early, never failed to take me away with him, whether I liked it or not, in order that I might do the same. It was not until just before my catastrophe that he ceased, for some reason unknown to me, to show me this attention. Even before I perceived any coldness on the part of Madame la Maréchale, I was anxious, in order to avoid exposing myself to it, to carry out my old plan. But as I was without the means, I was obliged to wait until the agreement of Émile was concluded, and in the meantime I put the final touches to the Contrat Social, and sent it to Ray, fixing the price of the manuscript at 1,000 francs, which he gave me. I ought not, perhaps, to omit a little incident which has reference to that manuscript. I handed it, carefully sealed, to Duvoisin, a minister from the Pays de Vaud and chaplain at the Hôtel de Hollande, who sometimes came to see me and undertook to forward it to Ray, with whom he was acquainted. This manuscript, written in a very fine hand, was very small and did not fill his pocket. However, as he was passing the barrière, the gate where the offices of the octroi, or town dues, were, it somehow or other fell into the hands of the clerks, who, after having opened and examined it, afterwards returned it to him when he claimed it in the name of the ambassador. This gave him the opportunity of reading it himself, which, as he ingenuously informed me, he did, at the same time praising the work highly, without a word of blame.